keep fighting voices in my mind that say I'm not enough. Every single lie that tells me I will never measure up. Am I more than just the sum of every high and every low? Remind me once again just who I am, because I need to know. When I can't feel a thing, you say I am strong. When I think I am weak, you say I am held. When I am falling short, and when I don't belong, oh, you say I am yours. And I believe. You'll have every failure, God. You'll have every victory. Ooh, oh, you say I am loved when I can't feel a thing. You say I am strong when I think I am weak. You say I am held when I
It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. James Berger tells that when he speaks to groups about divorce, that he begins with a little experiment. Now, I'm not going to ask you to do what he asks folks to do, but those attending the seminar are to raise their hand if any of the following are true. Raise your hand if you've ever been divorced. And then second, raise your hand if you are married to someone who has been divorced. And third, if someone in your immediate family has been divorced, parents, brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren, raise your hand. And I think you can imagine and probably guess that by the time he gets to the third question, most everyone in the room has by now raised their hand. I feel certain that by now, most of us would have raised our hands. For whatever perspective, we are a people who know about divorce in one way or another. We know how it affects relationships. We know the deep pain and damage that can come from a marriage that doesn't end well. We know that the tragedy of divorce doesn't impact a husband and a wife only, but that the consequences ripple throughout the family. We know that. And I want to say that if you are part of the group that would have raised your hand, I don't want you to feel embarrassed at all. For the reality is that nearly half of all marriages do end in divorce. There is hardly a family that hasn't felt the impact or hasn't been touched by the tragedy of divorce. As divorce has become more prevalent, of course, there has grown to be a greater acceptance of divorce. For children today, it is rather becoming uncommon for them to be living together with both biological mother and biological father. American children are the least likely in the entire Western world to grow up in the same household as biologically related parents. And study after study has been done on the effect of divorce on children. The emotional pain from a divorce leads to a whole slew of possibilities, from a feeling of rejection, from the effect of a child's stability and confidence and self-value. And it can lead to anger and bitterness and resentment, and you and I know that's just the tip of the iceberg. Generally, and I am praying, generally, I'm not talking about this church, but generally, the church has not always been helpful. The rate of divorce is just as high among church folk as it is in the general population. Only in the church, especially more conservative brands, they like to serve up, along with divorce, generous helpings of guilt, even rejection. Some even go so far as to stand in the way of remarriage, doing it all, of course, in Jesus' name. In a study by the Barna Group, on average, conservative Protestant Christians have the highest divorce rates at 34%, while mainline Christian groups have a lower rate at 24%. In fact, atheists and agnostics have the lowest rates at 21%. Who would have guessed? But no one is immune, no one. A survey of clergy by the Hartford Seminary found that 25% of clergy women and 20% of clergy men have been divorced at least once. This information is shared with the sole purpose of getting to what I hope will be a helpful question. The question is, so what does Jesus think about all of this? What views did Jesus share about divorce, and how should we think about it as we try to become Sermon on the Mount Christians? Remember, in this passage of Scripture, we are on the third statement of the teaching formula that Jesus uses to dig deeper into a commonly understood law. You remember the formula, don't you? You have heard it said, but I say unto you. And as Jesus did with murder and adultery before this one, so now Jesus speaks on the issue of divorce. He began with what those who were listening would already have known. What does Jesus think of this indeed? The world into which Jesus spoke had a double background. It was, of course, first the world of the Jews, but it was also the world of the Romans and Greeks, as they had combined to become the Roman Empire. They had different views about the sanctity, or in fact, the lack of sanctity of marriage, and the nature of divorce. First, the Jews. Of the dominant cultures in the Middle East in Jesus' day, the Jews certainly had the highest ideal, emphasize the word ideal, about marriage. When one had entered into the marriage relationship, they were undertaking a sacred duty. Men especially were, in fact, bound to marry. To not marry was to disobey the Genesis command to be fruitful and multiply. As such, Jews abhorred divorce. The prophet Malachi spoke these clear words for God. "I hate divorce," you would read in Malachi. However, the tragedy was that the practice did not match the ideal. Divorce was, in fact, common. And let us be clear, one thing detracted from the whole marriage relationship, and that is women in the eyes of the law were things. They were property. Property. The woman was at the absolute disposal of her father or of her husband. In essence, she had virtually no legal rights at all. In essence, a woman could not divorce her husband for any reason. And it would seem that the man could divorce his wife for almost any cause at all. The law in Deuteronomy 24:1 states, "Suppose a man enters into marriage with a woman, but she does not please him because he finds something objectionable about her. And so he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of the house." Can you imagine that? It was as simple as that in reason for divorce, and as simple as that in the execution of a divorce. But what in the world is something objectionable? Now, in the matter of Jewish law, there were two schools of interpretation. The school of Shammai stated clearly, it's the more severe of the schools, the school of Shammai stated clearly that the only reason for divorce would be adultery or unchastity. It was a very narrow interpretation. However, the school of Hillel had a very broad interpretation of what was something objectionable. And so, women were divorced for spoiling dinner by putting too much salt on the food. Women were divorced for going out in public with their head uncovered. Women were divorced for talking with men in the streets or for speaking disrespectfully about her in-laws. If a man found a woman more attractive than his wife, a certificate of divorce could be written, and the woman would be sent away. Which school do you think was getting the greatest following? In Jesus' day, divorce had become so easy that young women were actually unwilling to marry because it was such an insecure state of being. When Jesus spoke these words, he was addressing a country where national morals were growing more lax and family life was beginning to collapse. Does this sound familiar? Remember, the Roman Empire had conquered the Holy Land, and so now the influence of Greeks and Romans was everywhere. They may have been listening as Jesus spoke. The Greeks were the worst, but unfortunately became the most influential. Relationships outside of marriage for the Greeks carried no stigma. They were accepted, and they were even routine. Demosthenes, a statesman and renowned orator, wrote, "We have courtesans for the sake of pleasure, concubines for the sake of daily cohabitation, and wives for the purpose of having children legitimately and of having a faithful guardian to our household affairs." This is a huge paradox. The respectable woman was to live a life of seclusion, never going to the street alone, not taking her meals in the places where the men would eat, and not participating much in the social life with the husband. But meanwhile, he felt entitled to a life of immoral practice. When the Apostle Paul went to Corinth, he found an extraordinary situation. The temple of Aphrodite is there. I saw it when I was visiting in Corinth. It's on top of a huge promontory. The goddess of love, Aphrodite, was in the temple, and there grew an alliance of the practice of prostitution with religion. There were 1,000 priestesses in the temple of Aphrodite. At evening time, they would come down from the temple to the streets. Their proceeds would then sustain the cult. The practice was introduced to Athens as well as other places. There was a whole system, a social system of relationships outside of marriage. And they were accepted, as normal. What is more, in Greece, divorce had no legal process. All that must be done is for the man to dismiss his wife in the presence of two witnesses. The only good thing about it is he had to return her dowry so she could sustain herself. Christianity, you see, would need to speak to that horrid understanding of marriage and the matter of divorce. For the Romans, in early years, the home was everything. The wife was not bound to seclusion and participated in all of life. William Barclay notes that for the first 500 years of the Roman Commonwealth, there was not one single recorded case of divorce. In 234 BC, Spurius Corvilius Ruga divorced his wife because she was childless and he desired a child. But then the empire fell under the strong influence of the Greeks, and you can imagine it was downhill from there. The 19th century historian William Lecky reported on the Greek influence on the Romans, saying, "That outburst was ungovernable and almost became a frantic depravity which followed upon their contact with Greece." This is the world into which Christ came, and it's the notion of marriage and divorce that was held in the cultures of influence. Now, I fear that I've put you to sleep with all of this, and for that I am sorry, but you cannot understand what Jesus is saying without understanding why it was he said it. Again, back to the idea. So what do you think Jesus thinks of all of this? What is he claiming in this male-dominated culture? What is he trying to claim in a culture where the marriage bond was in danger of destruction? I think the answer is really quite simple. As you read it, I hope that you found it to be quite simple. Jesus is simply trying to reestablish the importance of a bond which should not be broken. In Matthew 19, Jesus attacks the problem again. This time, he is attacking divorce from the questions of the Pharisees. The Pharisees ask, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause?" And Jesus responds first by quoting Genesis 2:24, which says, "Therefore a man leaves his father and his mother and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh." And then he adds the clincher. Listen carefully. This is the clincher. "Those whom God has joined together, let no man separate." "Well," replied the Pharisees, "then why did Moses command us to draw up a written divorce notice and give it to her?" And Jesus flipped it right back to them, again saying, "It was because of your hardness of heart, your unteachable spirit, that Moses allows you to divorce your wives." "But in the beginning," he continues, "but in the beginning, that was not the state of things that was intended." Are we a bit clearer about what Jesus thinks of divorce? Are we? Well, let me go on. For here is my thinking on the matter. Divorce is never intended to be the first option. As a pastor, when I am asked to enter into conversations with a couple that is in pain and in danger of divorce, my responsibility is at first to see whether reconciliation is possible. It's not always possible, but we begin there and work toward that end. However, I am not so delusional as to think that all marriage relationships can be reconciled. I have performed well over 200 weddings, and I regret to tell you that not all of them have remained a couple. And it saddens me greatly. However, I have come to understand that there are those couples for whom it cannot be said, "Those whom God has joined together, let no one separate." In fact, some people get married, and God has absolutely nothing to do with it. Nothing. In fact, if they are not active in the church, and I am sometimes asked to do weddings that are outside of the church, of course, if they are not active in the church, I ask, "So why did you ask me to be a part of this wedding? What is it that you want? Well, we want a pastor there." "Well, do you want me to represent God in my priestly function? You want God to be present at your wedding, and that's why you've asked me to come?" And they'll say, "Yes." Well, if you want God to be present at your wedding, how are you going to make sure that God is going to be present in your marriage? That causes some stammering. That is to say, there are couples who get married whom God does not join together. People get married for all kinds of reasons. You know that. All kinds of reasons. Some of those reasons are not good. Also, it is possible that in the process of courtship, a person might not be so transparent as to reveal abusive tendencies or manipulative tendencies. I'm talking about both sides, men and women now. Some people are so wounded that they do what I call settle. They settle. They settle for a person who is bound to break and cause them pain. If a person has a tendency to abuse alcohol during courtship, it isn't very likely going to go away on a wedding day. Some will say, well, I'll fix him, or I'll fix her. They can change. Yes. Yes, they can. But probably not. And so I have been convinced again that there are some couples whom God does not join together. And there is no earthly reason for a man or woman to remain in a marriage that is abusive in ways that destroys the other, whether physically or emotionally. No Christian must remain in a marriage to a murderer, a thief, a liar, a slanderer, one who is hostile or violent, or a person given to any other illegal, immoral, or abusive behaviors. Better to be done with it, but it must be done in the highest integrity. We must always know this. God's mercy, God's grace will always trump God's laws. No one thinks that divorce is wonderful, except the gold digger who might be getting married in order to access someone's money. No one gets married in order to get divorced. When people marry, they hope and plan for a stable and constant faithful relationship of mutual support and care. When the relationship begins to break, becoming intolerable and even vicious, there is this tendency toward guilt and shame. If there are those here dealing with those feelings today, you are released. Please be released. Do not carry them. Do not carry them anymore. You see, we live in a tension between what is ideal, which would be no divorce, and the harsh realities that exist in a sinful world. That's the tension in which we live. Divorce is never the ideal. That's not what we're out for. And it is not always right. But by the grace of God, we can be forgiven, as God gives us another chance to get it right. We can learn. We can grow. We can do it. There's hope after divorce. I believe it because God has demonstrated it in front of my eyes over and over again.
Somewhere between the hot and the cold, somewhere between the new and the old, somewhere between who I am and who I used to be, somewhere in the middle you'll find me. Somewhere between the wrong and the right, somewhere between the darkness and the light, somewhere between who I was and who you're making me, somewhere in the middle you'll find me. Just how close can I get, Lord, to my surrender without losing all control? between my heart and my hand. Somewhere between my faith and my plans. Somewhere between the safety of the boat and the crashing waves. Somewhere between a whisper and a roar. Somewhere between the altar and the door. When I'm caught in the middle.